Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to our podcast series, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. This is the seventh talk in the series and the first on the topic of living in wisdom. The Buddha once said, The wise one established in virtue, developing mental composure and wisdom, that ardent and prudent monk, it is he who disentangles his tangle. The practice of virtue straightens out our emotional life. It tames the greed and aversion that so poorly serve the well-being of ourselves and others. But the impulse for greed and aversion is held in place by delusion, our conceptual misunderstanding of the world in which we live. The practice of wisdom straightens out our understanding of the world. It removes the delusion that limits our negotiation with the world. The passage, just cited, sees practice as a process of disentangling ourselves from the knotted mesh of our problematic, samsaric lives. Virtue loosens the grosser tangles. This gives us space to deal with the tighter, thornier knots of delusion. The practice of wisdom begins with right understanding and is perfected in mental composure. It starts with developing a conceptual grasp of the human condition. It proceeds through the recognition of this condition in our own lived experience, and it concludes with a full internalization of the Dharma as a matter of direct perception. This is a matter of achieving knowledge and vision of things as they really are, the precursor to complete awakening. Developing right understanding. The process of development of right understanding is described in the five stages of liberation. The teacher or a fellow monk in a position of a teacher teaches the Dharma to a monk. He himself teaches the Dharma to others in detail as he has heard it and learned it. He recites the Dharma in detail as he has heard it and learned it. He ponders, examines, and mentally inspects the Dharma as he has heard it and learned it. He has grasped well a certain object of mental composure, attended to it well, sustained it well, and penetrated it well with wisdom. This passage is quaint in that it reflects the method of rote memorization that was needed in pre-literate India to access and preserve the Dharma. With modern access to written texts, we can actually proceed more quickly to step four and then five. But then we modern people have to jump back over and over to check our understanding in the discourses while we mindfully observe the unending alighting and flight of phenomena around body and mind. In this way, we penetrate the Dharma in our own experience. The Dharma develops from scripture to something integrated into a wide fabric of experience, to something internalized beyond the conceptual, to the point that we effectively perceive through the eyes of the Buddha. A bird watcher will go through a similar process, just like students of a lot of other skills. She begins with reading or consulting the Peterson Field Guide, which gives her sketches, descriptions, and seasonal distribution maps. With book in hand, she tries to remember the colors, markings, behavioral patterns, and calls described there. Then she brings her understanding attentively to mind as she observes alightings and flights around feeder and bush, sometimes checking back with her book. The more she engages in her hobby, the more her understanding is refined, and it becomes integrated with her knowledge of local landscape and flora. After a while, much of her understanding becomes internalized as a matter of direct perception of the feathery realm. She needs only to catch the slightest motion and glimpse of a tail in order to identify in an instant without thought, "Oh, a Carolina chickadee!" Effectively, she has learned to see through the eyes of Roger Torrey Peterson. Mindfulness is instrumental at each of these stages of liberation. We need to bring the Dharma to mind. Since we're applying attentive mindfulness and ardency, if distractions are also put aside, we might expect mental composure to arise, like in the case of virtue, refuge, and general mindfulness. This is indeed the case. The full passage for each of the five stages of liberation concludes identically with the by now familiar causal chain: delight gives rise to tranquility, gives rise to mental composure. In whatever way he experiences inspiration in the meaning and inspiration in the Dhamma, as he does so, joy arises in him. When he is joyful, delight arises. For one with a delighted mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes composed. This is the first, alternatively second, third, etc., stage of liberation. In modern circles, teachers usually don't mention that recitation can be an integral part of mental composure practice. The special and most completive last stage of liberation, in which mental composure is mentioned up front as with respect to an object of mental composure, will be considered in more detail in a bit. In this podcast, we take up Dharma, how Dharma relates to lived experience, and how we internalize Dharma. This is a huge topic. It is actually the primary concern of the Buddha's most profound teachings. We'll provide only an overview of this topic in this short talk, but hopefully reveal the general logic of the Buddha's approach. Understanding experience. Imagine the following situation. The first rays of sunlight against my eyelids, a cold sensation against my cheek, and I know my dog is there trying to wake me up. Clinking sounds, and I know family members are already in the kitchen making breakfast. I open my eyes, and it comes back to me. I was arrested last night for drunken and disorderly conduct. The cold sensation is a metal bar I rolled into in my bed, and the clinking sound is the sheriff opening my cell. I had fabricated a false reality and taken it to be true. We've talked about greed and aversion and how they inspire unskillful actions. Delusion is a bit more elusive because, in general, we do not see our delusions. That's what makes them delusions. Delusions are a quality of experience in which what we are experiencing fails to reach how things really are. The problem for us is that we then behave on the basis of our delusions, often in very unskillful and harmful ways. So how do we recognize our delusions? One, we can observe ourselves fabricating our delusions in our own minds. Two, we can notice inconsistencies between the different things we think we know. And three, we can notice that there are alternative ways of interpreting what we think we know. What we cannot do is directly compare what we experience as true with reality itself, that is, with the objective world out there as it exists before we experience it. We do not have any access to the world out there independently of what we fabricate in our own experience with all of its delusions. This might not seem obvious at first because it sure seems like we have direct access to the world out there. Chair, keyboard, window, dog, podcast, microphone. but that is part of the delusion. Here's a modern argument that makes this clear. Let's assume the brain is implicated in the arising of experience. Consider that the brain sits in the skull in total darkness and total silence. It communicates with the world out there through neural impulses originating in the retina, in the eardrum, and so on. This is raw data, so it must be reinterpreted to reproduce the complete experience of the world out there. Therefore, everything we experience as real is in fact a fabricated and potentially delusive representation in the mind. This does not deny that there is a world out there, only that we never really see it. For the Buddha, mind precedes all phenomena. Mind is their chief. They are all mind-made. We can understand phenomena here in the simplest way. A phenomenon is an event, object, or other factor as it occurs in experience. Examples of phenomena are urges, feelings, ideas, plans, attentions, imaginings, but those things that we tend to privilege in our experience with separate existence out there are also phenomena insofar as we experience them. Among these are table, chairs, our bodies, our loved ones, our cars, ourselves. Our delusions are also phenomena, and they arise in cognitive dependence on other phenomena. When we think there is an objective world out there, that is just another phenomenon. Phenomena form a kind of closed system. And in fact, the Buddha uses the word world in this specific sense. The world is the totality of phenomena, all that we experience. It's important to recognize this strongly subjective orientation of the early Dharma. Otherwise, we will become confused in our study of the Dharma. For the Buddha, in this fathom-long living body, along with its perceptions and thoughts, lies the world, the arising of the world, and the cessation of the world. This orientation has a great advantage. It grounds the Dharma and our practice empirically in that which we can directly experience. In our delusion, we fabricate the world as we experience it, then convince ourselves that this world is real, and then behave according to what we think is real. This is what keeps us entangled in the samsaric condition. With right understanding, we question our fabrications and therefore learn how we can disentangle ourselves from our fabrications. It's in the phenomenal world that we suffer, it's here that we practice, and it's here that we awaken. Everything is contingent. The phenomenal world, and we might presume the world out there as well, is for the Buddha strictly subject to cause and effect. Phenomena arise from causes and conditions, and in turn constitute causes and conditions for the arising of other phenomena. Conditionality, or cause and effect, is the relation between two phenomena when the arising or cessation of one is contingent on the arising or cessation of the other. In the early text, this is standardly expressed as follows. When this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. It's this simple insight that allowed the Buddha to crack open our deluded and persistent misperception of the world to reveal clearly how we entangle ourselves in samsara. It should be appreciated that conditionality makes all elements of experience contingent on other elements, since a given element is both effect of other elements and conditions for other elements. Conditionality, for the Buddha, is taken as a universal principle that ripples through chains of causality and that keeps the world in constant flux. Nothing happens by itself, but only through conditions. And there is no first condition to anything. Everything arising in this way is unsubstantial and contingent. This is nature without artifice. The most prominent example of conditionality in all of Dharma is the Second Noble Truth, stated here in one of its alternative forms. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of suffering, the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for becoming other. This can be abbreviated as craving gives rise to suffering. Here is where the appeal to conditionality gets clever. If we understand what things arise from what conditions, this gives us the opportunity to engineer more desirable outcomes by tracing back chains of conditionality to factors we are better able to steer. Take a concrete example of this principle. We cannot extinguish a fire directly nor make it burn more brightly, but we can achieve the desired outcome if we understand the conditions that give rise to fire: oxygen, heat, and fuel. Each of these can be directly manipulated. Dousing the fire with water deprives it of oxygen and reduces its temperature. Throwing another log on gives it more fuel. Blowing on the fire may give it more oxygen, but also reduce its temperature. All of our experience is subject to similar considerations. The recourse to conditionality allows us, through Buddhist practice, to bring the fires of suffering under control by controlling their conditions, such as craving. If we cannot will craving to end, we look for the conditions of craving and then try to control those, and so on. Origination of undesirable factors is thereby matched with their desirable cessation, as in the Third Noble Truth. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. If we don't know how to manipulate craving directly, we can inquire as to its conditions and so on. Although every factor of experience or of the world out there is highly contingent and in flux, we often experience the world out there unreliably as more permanent, more pleasurable, more personalized, and more beautiful than things really are. We fabricate this in our delusion as a world of rather fixed things. Then we become attached to them, and then we suffer as a consequence. Our own self is the primary example as we come to live in wisdom. Striving for personal advantage does not even make sense, and the me disappears into nature, that is, into the flux. With this in mind, the Buddha asks us always to keep in mind the three qualities characteristic of all conditioned phenomena: impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Impermanence is the quality of being in flux, born from conditions and also dying with conditions. Impermanence applies, of course, to thoughts, to feelings, and so on, but also to what is out there, to the food we buy, to our furniture, to our car, to our own bodies, even to mountains. Impermanence entails that everything and everyone we cherish will be lost to us one by one until the ones that remain lose us. The world is slipping by like sand through our fingers. There is no happy ever after with regard to the things or people of the world. Suffering is conditioned by craving, the craving that causes us to attach to the things of the world. But because these things are in flux, we cannot find lasting satisfaction in them. Our conceptual experiences simply do not keep pace with the unfolding of the world out there. Because things are impermanent, when we seek gratification in something fixed, we forget that samsaric life has been a continual series of broken promises. What is craved causes us suffering because we cannot rely on it. If we've lost what we cherish, we suffer. If we still have it, we're anxious that we will lose it. Non-self questions the view that there is something substantial and lasting that we call me. We will never find such a thing. If we fully integrate this teaching, we never have to take anything personally. Everything is simply the unfolding of nature. In the meantime, we fabricate a sense of self from the attachments that we appropriate as me and mine. These include body, fortune, family, and bowling championship. But what we think is more or less fixed will really turn out to be impermanent, and if we attach to it anyway, it'll just be a source of suffering. If it's impermanent and a source of suffering, we wouldn't want it to be ourself anyway. Yuck. Thinking about impermanence, suffering, and non-self reveals the false premises that underlie much of the world as we have grown to know it. As an empirical matter, these three qualities win all debates. Still, we find it surprisingly easy to overlook them. The three qualities remind us that all objects, even if we're convinced they exist out there, are by nature unreliable, and explain why they cause us distress when we have a stake in them or try to identify with them. In whatever way they imagine, thereby it turns otherwise. These reflections aim at the fading of passion. Our infatuations are over things that are too hot to handle, things that are not what they promise. It's important to recognize that a meaningful life lies elsewhere.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is Sitagu, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.